the Starliner decision, and bees on the space station, you're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Engineers continue to investigate issues on Boeing's Starliner capsule as NASA weighs its options in bringing the crew home. Astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams launched the station in Starliner back in June, but issues with the spacecraft's propulsion system are putting their ride home in limbo. We'll speak with Don Platt, the director of Florida Tech's Spaceport Education Center in Titusville and an associate professor of space systems, about the engineering decisions at hand. Then, Butch, Sonny, and the other crew members of the ISS have some insect buddies on board, robotic bees. Are We There Yet? Marion Summerall introduces us to the Astro Bees with a conversation with the Hive's lead project engineer. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? As engineers continue to investigate propulsion issues on Boeing's Starliner spacecraft, NASA is weighing its options in bringing the crew home. Boeing says it has confidence in the safety of the spacecraft. NASA says its engineers are still debating whether to use the capsule or ask another commercial partner, SpaceX, to bring the crew home in a Dragon capsule. The agency says a decision will not come this week. Is Don Platt, the director of Florida Tech's Spaceport Education Center in Titusville and an associate professor of space systems. Don, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let's start with Starliner remains in the news, and there's still no date to return NASA astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams at this point. Can you kind of recap some of the engineering issues or challenges that both Boeing and NASA are looking into when it comes to the safety of Starliner?
The issues kind of started even before they launched, when they had some helium leaks, some problems with the pressurization system on board the Starliner systems. And so they monitored those and finally decided it was okay to launch. And then once they got into orbit, they realized that they were getting less thrust than they had anticipated out of some of their rocket engines. And of course, these engines are used to maneuver and point the vehicle and safely dock and undock. And so this, of course, is a major concern in terms of making sure the astronauts can safely undock from the International Space Station and get back into the atmosphere and return to the Earth. So they've been essentially taking the time while they are docked and, of course, have plenty of food and water and supplies and all living on the space station to try to analyze what went wrong and understand as much as they can about the system. And, of course, make sure it is safe then to finish out the mission.
What does some of that testing entail, Don? What would NASA and Boeing need to do to, you know, give mission managers confidence that those thrusters will work, be able to safely undock, as you've outlined, and safely steer themselves back through the atmosphere to where they need to land?
Well, it really started with analyzing the data that they collected while the Starliner was heading to the International Space Station. And so they're looking at things like temperatures and pressures and the overall health of the thruster system. And since they've been on the International Space Station, they have actually done some thruster firings, what they called hot fire testing of the thrusters to see how they perform. And they've also done similar testing to ground systems that they have here on the Earth so that they could maybe recreate the types of issues that they're seeing in space, because that's the best way to understand something is to recreate it.
So this is not, in a sense, Boeing and NASA trying to figure out a way to fix the thrusters. It's to understand the risk involved in using the thrusters as they are at this particular moment, right?
Yeah, there's probably very little they can do to fix them at this point. What they can do is rely on the redundancy. Of course, any human vehicle has redundant systems. And so you don't have a single failure that is going to totally cause a mission to be unsuccessful. And so what they can do is they can look at what thrusters are working properly and how can we then use those thrusters to efficiently get the vehicle back into the atmosphere and then to the surface of the Earth.
You mentioned that these issues popped up before the launch. They noticed the helium leak. It was exacerbated in orbit. They noticed a lot more helium leaking and then obviously these thrusters. Before this mission even launched, Don, do you think that it was premature? Were these issues that should have grounded the spacecraft before it launched?
Well, I think that the only problem that they saw before they launched was the helium problem. And I think that they had an expectation that they understood that problem and that for the time that they expected to be on orbit anyway, that wouldn't be a problem. for them. I think that they have essentially sealed off those helium tanks at this point. And so there is no leak that's sort of continuing right now. Now, of course, once they are operational again to undock, they're going to have to open up those helium tanks again. And so they will start leaking again at that point. But these additional thruster problems are things that they did not anticipate at all. These are totally out of the blue problems that were very much unexpected.
So while they are happening kind of in parallel, they're not related to one another?
They are on the same system, but interestingly enough, they're two separate problems.
This is a test flight. I mean, it's in the mission name, right? Crew Flight Test 1. Issues like this could pop up, should pop up during a test flight like this. But I mean, is this beyond the scope of a safe crew test flight mission? Or is this par for the course when it comes to a brand new vehicle on its first mission carrying crew?
Well, I think that we've had a lot of success in space over the last decade or so. And we've probably gotten used to things going perfectly right. Although space is not that easy, and we can see problems. And so problems do pop up from time to time. Even back in the days of the shuttle program, there used to be issues with the orbiter, even on orbit, and they'd have to think about, can we keep flying this mission or do we need to return to the Earth? You know, with the fact that they have the International Space Station, this has really given them sort of some margin, really. I think that they would have gone ahead and returned the crew. If they say they were just on an orbital mission and they were by themselves, like so many shuttle missions were, they probably would have come back by now, but they've wanted to take the time to truly understand this. And as you say, it's a test mission. And so gather as much data as you possibly can and collect it up, well, so that in the future, you fully understand the operation of this vehicle and it can operate in a safe manner.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Don Platt, the director of Florida Tech's Spaceport Education Center in Titusville. And he's an associate professor of space systems. We're talking about the Starliner mission. Don, last week we heard from NASA officials, and we got the sense that there was some people think that it was safe to return Butch and Sonny, and others don't. And they raise concerns there. When you hear from Boeing, Boeing says it is confident in the performance of Starliner. But going back to NASA, to hear that kind of, you know, dissenting opinion within the Corps of Engineering, what does that say about the way NASA is measuring the safety of this vehicle and weighing the options of bringing Butch and Sonny back? In so many words, what does it mean that there is dissent within NASA?
Well, you know, I think it's actually a good thing. I think that we saw in the shuttle program days, there were what they called cultural issues, organizational cultural issues, where dissenting opinions were squelched, where people who did not sort of toe the party line, if you will, were not listened to, or even worse situations. So here, I think it's important that they're listening to everybody's opinion and taking all of the data and seeing where it goes. As this is something that, again, the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, after the Shuttle Columbia accident, said that NASA had not properly looked at data and analyzed it and really tried to understand what the data was telling them. And so I think this is encouraging that there's dissenting opinions and that NASA is even acknowledging it to some level in a public forum to really have everybody have an opinion about what's happening. Because again, they don't have to deorbit tomorrow. And so if there's some opinions that are not agreeing with the overall opinion, they are definitely looking at why that is the case and what other information should they gather and what else should go into the decision of when they finally do come home.
And going into that decision of whether to bring them home in Starliner or, as NASA outlined, the possible plan of sending SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule up there, I'm sure NASA mission managers are weighing the risk of that too, right? Because there has to be some sort of risk in bringing Butch and Sonny home in a different spacecraft, right? They need new suits. They need to send a spacecraft up with less weight. What goes into that kind of assessing of challenges and engineering issues in sending up a Dragon spacecraft?
There's definitely a bunch of engineering issues, like you said, new spacesuits. Uncertain how much training Butch and Sonny have had in the Dragon capsule. They've been working full bore on the Starliner for the last 5-6 years at least. And so they really understand those systems like the back of their hand. But that's sort of like then suddenly showing up in a completely different airplane and being expected to fly it. And of course, then there are the political questions about this too. I don't think NASA any more than Boeing wants to say, oh, the Starliner couldn't successfully complete its mission and we had to bring our astronauts home on a different vehicle. I think NASA is probably just about as reluctant to want to do that as Boeing is.
Regardless of what happens with Butch and Sonny, whether they come back on Starliner or Starliner comes back empty and Butch and Sonny return on Dragon, what is the future path for the Starliner program? This was a crewed flight test to get certification to go on operational missions. What happens when that vehicle comes back with or without a crew? And what does that mean for the future of Starliner?
Well, I think that if it has to come back without a crew, then that's definitely a setback in terms of certifying it for a completely crewed mission, where all aspects of the mission have astronauts on board. It depends on the appetite that NASA has for wanting to have to do yet another certification flight. But it may come down to that then. I think that clearly Boeing would not want to have to do that. But I think certainly if the crew members do not come home on Starliner, we can't say that it has been certified to be operational.
Yeah, that's kind of a big piece, right, is coming back with a crew to certify it.
Yeah, safely returning the crew is a big part of the mission, definitely.
Finally, Don, I mean, this has been a very, very public mission, maybe more public than Boeing would want it to be with kind of the press that it's getting. But do you feel that the general public is having, you know, different views of space travel and the safety of space travel these days? What does it mean to have such public failures like this for Boeing and for NASA?
I think that SpaceX has kind of spoiled us in some ways with their successes, and we have so many launches that we don't even really pay attention when another launch occurs anymore because they happen so readily. But this just reminds us that the space environment is very hostile, and it takes a lot to successfully fly a mission. Now, obviously, there's other issues unrelated to space that Boeing has been facing lately, and we see aspects of that and discussions on that almost daily. And so this definitely does not help the public perception of Boeing as a company right now and the confidence that people have in their ability to successfully complete missions.
We've been speaking with Don Platt, the director of Florida Tech's Spaceport Education Center in Titusville and associate professor of space systems. Don, thank you so much for your insight.
Sure. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Still to come, along with astronauts living on the space station, there are also bees, but they're not real. Astrobees are robots that assist astronauts on board, buzzing about, helping with experiments and many other tasks. That is sure to be a great conversation. Sorry, I had to do it. Stay listening. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. There's a buzz about on the International Space Station, and it's attributed to a hive of robotic bees. The Astrobees are a trio of free-flying autonomous bots on board the ISS. The bots were launched back in 2018, but could recent developments in their autonomous work pave the way for robotic assistance on the Artemis missions to the moon and beyond? Are We There Yet's Marion Summerall caught up with NASA's Andreas Moravargas to see what all the buzz is about.
Andreas, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So these are little robots on the ISS. What exactly are the Astrobees?
They are essentially a research platform. And what we do is that we allow people from all over the world to have access to the International Space Station so that they can test their experiments. What we do is that we allow software and hardware after they have gone through a submittal process. And we help the industry, academia, and even other NASA centers and other international partners to carry out and take their own operations and demonstrate different technologies. And some of those technologies are actually going to be used down here on Earth. So some people use it to test materials. Some people use it to demonstrate capabilities like on-orbit servicing. So there's a wealth of different experiments that people can do. So in a nutshell, those are robots that help other people access the International Space Station in a way that it is unique.
So they first were launched back in 2018, and since then they have done a lot of work on the ISS. They've logged over 1,000 hours working on the ISS, right? I mean, they're really busy.
That is correct. We have done over 1,200 hours of work, and we have done that going above and beyond, if you may. We have been helping anywhere from middle-high students to put their code on board of the International Space Station. And then we also have, we can go from there to allowed companies such as Bosch to do a demonstration of their technologies in order to understand if it is possible to create sonic maps or audio maps of an area. And that is essentially payload that Bosch, the company, created, and that they have an array of microphones that they then attach to one of the astrobees. And then the astrobee moves in a continuous fashion inside of, let's say, the Japanese experimental module, or GEM. In doing so, it creates this map of sounds. And if payload listens to a sound that has not listened for a while, then it can generate an alarm. And so if there is a problem, in this case, crew members will be able to understand that there is a problem through that alarm. And interestingly, this technology can be also used in manufacturing or in plants where there's lots of manufacturing, where you could put a mobile robot and attach the same type of payload and create a monitoring robot that will help maintain the safety of that environment. There is a currently a payload that is essentially trying to demonstrate the capabilities of capturing another robot. In this case, we have three robots on the station, but one of them is called Bumble, the other one is Queen, because of course they are all bees, right? And so we have Bumble, Queen, and Honey, but in this particular experimentation, they have Bumble having a, let's call it a tentacle, and they are trying to grasp an object. And by grasping very gently that object, they are demonstrating the capability of a future satellite providing on-orbit servicing. So it's a very interesting set of activities that we can provide and that we can give to all this type of investigations.
I guess you could say they are busy bees, right? Where did this idea come from to make the astrobees? And how did the name astrobees come about? Take me back to the original idea of why they were created.
Going back in time, we used to have and operate the Sphere robots. Imagine a set of robots that were able to provide experiments similar to what we do now in astrobee. But the problem that those robots had was that it was they were constrained in the amount of time that they could run for any given experiment. In addition to that, the programming of the robots was somewhat cumbersome, since the computer power was very limited as well. Now, we took those as motivation, and the people who designed the astrobee essentially thought of a modular way to do this so that new hardware and software could be easily installed, and so that the robots could be used for, like I said, a variety of tasks and to carry out all that wide range of experiments, even those that we haven't even imagined. That's one of the things that I love about astrobee, that you never get to do the same thing twice. It's great. Taking those constraints, the people that work on the design phase essentially came up with a great idea that we then need to be constrained on those consumables, mainly that propulsion. And so what we did was that we grabbed a robot, or we built a robot that is modular, that you can suck in air through two propulsion modules. Additional to that, we not only have one, but we have three different computers. We have what we call the low level, the mid level, and the high level. And each of these computers have very specific tasks. And interestingly enough, this high level processor is based off a computer that is similar to having a cell phone. So much so that we use an Android operating system, so that people all over the world have an easier way to control it. So in a way, you could say that if you can, at home, those who are listening, if you're able to, you know, plug your phone to your computer and, you know, light up a little bit of a program that says hello world on your cell phone, you'll be able to do something similar to that over in the robot. So that is how we are trying to simplify and make it more accessible to a lot of people in the world.
Fascinating. And it seems like with that technology, you're able to have that collaboration. I'm curious to know how the Astrobees collaborate and work with each other. And what about assisting astronauts? How do these bees work, and how do they work with people?
As a matter of fact, I can tell you by the fact that the Spheres robots that I was mentioning before, they had those two constraints, power and propulsion, but also they needed to be, they needed a nanny all the time. They needed a crew member or crew members to be around them. Now, with Astrobee, we actually have something that we call crew minimal. And crew minimal activities are those where the robots, we just tell them, okay, let's go do this particular task. And the robot goes by itself through a plan, grab all that information, and then come back to a particular position and wait for additional requests. And so that if we wanted to have the robot move from one place to another, that we just indicate, okay, do so through an interface that we develop. And we just essentially stay back and look, right? And so it is through this manner that we can really tell that the robots are certainly autonomous, and they have liberated the crew members from essentially babysitting them. One of the things that we have done that are very interesting is that students, thanks to our international partnership that we created with JAXA, is that we have been able to impact thousands of students through a competition called the Kibo Robotic Programming Challenge. And this essentially posts a challenge to students at every different countries. I call this the World Cup of space robotics, because essentially every single country tries to qualify to become the one country that is going to represent, the one team that is going to represent that country. And so those who do become the queen bee come down to the ISS, and they actually interact with the crew. We also incorporate machine learning and artificial intelligence into the mix, so that they have to recognize different objects that are printed and put in different locations. And so the crew tells the robot, go please fetch me, I don't know, a screwdriver, and the robot can go and do that, and points to where the screwdriver is and things of this sort. So that also is a demonstration of that capability of collaborating and help crew members.
I want to jump back to something you said earlier, that the possibilities of Astrobees are endless. What about future missions? Do these Astrobees have plans to leave the ISS, or are there any other plans for them? What's next for the future of these robots?
Well, you know very well that NASA explores the unknown in both air and space, right? And so we are expecting the knowledge that we are grabbing with the Astrobee robots to help increase the crew productivity, and hopefully even maintain a spacecraft at Moon and Mars and, you know, anywhere else we go and explore, especially when the astronauts are present. One possibility may be that of Gateway. Once, as we know, it is not going to be a crewed station. And so something or someone or something has to, keep tabs on that. And so not necessarily Astrobee, but perhaps the next generation of Astrobees may be the answer to that. I think that NASA inspires the world through discovery, right? And so what we're trying to do here is to discover what are those next steps. Like I said, working with Astrobee is one of the greatest things ever because you never get to do the same thing twice. What we are really constant at is the fact that we are always pushing what is possible in terms of automation and robotics in general, especially in this very dynamic, very extreme environments like those in space. The way that we could go outside, because right now Astrobees are only intended for intravehicular activities. To make them extravehicular activities, we would have to do redesign of the propulsion, obviously, because we don't have air that we can use outside of the station in space. But we could use thrusters and we can do other types of propulsion method. Then we also would have to create the proper mechanism so that we can protect the electronics and the sensors that we need for navigational purposes. And that in itself is something that we're already learning how to do properly inside of the ISS so that we can go beyond. So I am really excited to see what we can do from now on in all the other possible experiments and all the research that people have that may be cementing the path to get to that point where we can really answer what and how to do that work outside of the ISS and to go and explore the moon, Mars, and beyond.
Well, you will have to keep us up on the buzz that's happening with Astrobees. I can't help but make bee puns with
course.
This one.
One must, right? Absolutely. We have to keep buzzing, for sure.
Andreas Morga Vargas is the Astrobee engineering lead. Andreas, thank you so much for joining us today. And I can't wait to hear more about what these little bees are up to.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Are We There Yet's Marion Summerall speaking with NASA's Andreas Morga Vargas. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show or you want to join us as a guest, reach out to us. We're at AWTY@cfpublic.org. We've got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? It is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Sophie Diaz was our summer intern, and her last piece of work was finding that Astrobees story. So thank you very much, Sophie, for your hard work this summer. Best of luck to you in the future. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.